Blog Talk Radio.
This is the ACAC Radio Network. Welcome to Ministry Beat, a show designed to highlight the latest happenings here at Allegheny Center Alliance Church with your host, John Stanko. This program will focus on people, events, and current ministries at ACAC, a vibrant urban congregation in the heart of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And now, here is your host, John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in internet radio land. This is John Stanko, your host for Ministry Beat. And good to be back with you. Good to be here on a Tuesday. I'm going to be here for the month, and so it's good to be with you today. I am, I just said the same thing twice. There we go. I had discarded my Sunday bulletin, and I just wanted to go through it and see if there's anything we needed to be aware of. Yes, I was in church over the weekend, finally, after being gone the entire month of June, and no Saturday service on July the 4th, so it was great to be back. Pastor Rock shared a message on A Tale of Two Stories. I thought he did a great job. And I even had an ACAC event last night. Monday, I met with the Divine Design Team, the team that helps me help other people find their purpose. And so we had a great picnic out at Nada Jordan's and talked about the way forward in our future. And so I'm looking through the bulletin. Usually I will sit at some point and circle things that may be of interest to us. There is the Shadowed Faces, Jackson the Beat Fox. Jackie and Josh Blanchard will be performing at the church July 24th at 7 o'clock, answering questions about the trafficking issue, and an offering will be received for them. And so also looking at expanding the influence of the Holy Spirit is a conference that we have coming up August 31st to September the 3rd. You know, it's interesting. It says the conference, it says the dates, it says the times. I guess it must be at the church because it doesn't say anything else. And so then we've got Ravi Zacharias coming to Soldiers and Sailor October 15th. If you've never heard of Ravi, or if you have, you're going to want to go out and hear him. Great speaker and apologist, and very dynamic for defending the faith. And so that's about all I can see in the bulletin that would be of interest to us. Next week, I'll tell you up front already, I'm going to have Michael Gregory on. Michael is the head of our aftercare program, the work that we do with families and inmates who have been recently incarcerated and released. And so that Michael's been after me for a while to be on. We couldn't work it out for today. And I was looking for another guest, but then I thought, you know, wait a minute. I've mentioned that I was on a Returning to the Roots of Civil Rights tour, and it was really a life-changing experience. And so I thought, you know, a couple of weeks ago I broadcast in two parts our Living in a Racialized Society forum that we had in the church during the late winter last year. And so I thought it would be good if I just reported to you what I did. Now this tour has been going on for, this was the 14th year, and it is put on by an organization called the Common Ground Project, and that is run by my good friend Dr. Todd Allen, who was of Geneva College, now teaching at Grove City. And he's been doing this for a while, obviously, and has some support from PNC Foundation. And so every year he puts people on a bus and takes them down for what he calls the Returning to the Roots of Civil Rights Tour. In fact, I'm tracking Dr. Allen on Facebook these days, and he's back down south in Montgomery. Was in Selma, and I haven't seen any update today on where he is. So this has been his life's passion. His adult's work is connecting people to the history of the civil rights movement. And And it was quite an impactful tour. We started out on the 13th of June, got on a bus. I didn't know anybody except Dr. Allen. There were 20-some other people on the bus, a number from Messiah College who has committed to this tour every year for the last 3 or 4 years to send staff. Next year they said they're going to send some students. So get on a bus, go down to Greensboro, North Carolina, where we saw the museum, International Civil Rights Museum, that focused on the date February 1st, 1960. And that was the day that four freshmen from North Carolina A&T decided that if Woolworths was going to take their money for toothpaste, then Woolworths was going to take their money if they sat at the lunch counter for lunch or breakfast. And, of course, there were segregation laws that forbid African Americans from sitting at the lunch counters, so they began to sit and protest, and this spread like wildfire all throughout the South. And 6 months later, Woolworths rescinded their segregation rules and regulations at their lunch counters, and so we read and saw and watched a whole lot of information about that. Then next day we were at the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta, and spent a couple of hours there. If you've never been there, if you ever have some time in Atlanta, make sure you get over to the King Center. And it was a Sunday morning, so Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is still a viable congregation in the heart of Atlanta that Dr. King Sr. and Jr. had pastored, it has a new building, and it was open for business, and people were coming into church, and that was great to see. And so you get to see the King Parsonage where they lived and when they were pastoring, and the Center for Nonviolent Protest, and his the tomb graves of Mr. and Dr. Mrs. King are on the site. So that was very, very special. It was hot. Oh, it was so hot. And that afternoon, we went over to Georgia State, where we were lectured by Dr. Glenn Askew, who has written the book about the civil rights movement, a history professor at Georgia State. And then Mrs. Juanita Abernathy joined us. And I have a 40-minute presentation that she made. I'm not going to play it today. I may do it on a future show. And for me, she was the most impactful of anybody on the tour for my own personal reasons. But all the veterans we met, and this is the distinctive of this tour. You just don't go, the bus doesn't take you to the sites. Dr. Allen connects you with veterans, survivors, as it were, of the civil rights movement. And they share their insights and stories and music, and you're going to hear some of that. And then we went from Atlanta, traveled down to Albany, Georgia, way down south, down by Columbus, where there is a military base. And some people that I've talked to, even since I've been back, have told me they and their family stayed at that base for a while. But down in Albany was the Albany movement. And that's where we met Rutha Mae Harris, who is one of the Freedom Singers. And this was a quartet of singers who sang freedom songs during the civil rights movement. And why do I keep saying Joanne? And Rutha talked to us about the role of music in the movement. And it was quite impactful. She still got a voice that could to cut through concrete, and she gave us a recording, but I had a handheld recorder, and so I was able to capture some of her songs. Now, please excuse, this recorder is a plastic recorder, and anytime you move it or hold it, you get the sound of the plastic, the internal sound of the recorder. So I apologize when you're going to hear that, but look past that. And I may not have the volume set right. You may have to raise your volume. And while we're listening, I can go into some of the other clips and make sure I have an increase those. So listen real carefully, because this is Rutha Mae Harris singing "Freedom is a Constant Struggle." And certainly we think still about the issues and problems in our own culture and society and in societies with ISIS and others around the world. So let's listen to Ruth Mae Harris's rendition of Freedom is a Constant Struggle, and then I'll be back and we'll lead you through the rest of the tour and give you some of my own personal commentary. So here's Ruth Mae Harris.
Finally, I got a chance to watch TV, and the person who brought us out there, we could watch TV and use his landline. But when I got back to the bread and breakfast, no TV, no phone, no radio, just the bed. But I did enjoy myself with a wonderful, wonderful time. They say that freedom is a constant struggle. They say that freedom is a constant struggle. They say that freedom is a constant struggle. Oh Lord, we've been struggling so long. We must be free. We must be free. They say that freedom is a constant dying. They say
yeah.
Well, there, that didn't work out too bad. You know, the controls changed on this, so I do have a little more freedom to control the volume than we used to have on each clip that plays. Well, Ruth May obviously can still bring it. You couldn't quite hear at the beginning that she was up in Massachusetts, so she still travels, still ministers in song. But a delightful woman. And Albany, I think she told us that she was 9 when she was first arrested. One of the clips I have, she's describing going to jail. I'm not sure I have that one loaded. you have to download things to your computer and then load them back up to this website. So anyway, I'm not sure I got all of them up. But she sang, you know, 5 or 6 songs for us. There's another one that just speaks to the dedication of the movement, protesters. And in Albany, there was a Mayor Kelly and there was a Sheriff Pritchett. And so this song is Turn Me Around. She may mention, I know she mentions Pritchett. I can't remember if she mentions Mayor Kelly. But let's go ahead now and listen to Ruth May Harris in her rendition of Turn Me Around.
The Freedom Song came with religion, gospel, rhythm and blues, any music that was popular. Freedom Song came, changed the lyrics. Fit the occasion. Whatever the occasion was, freedom songs were made. The songs kept us from being afraid, kept us from fearing the billy club that was looking you right in the face. Well, he tells you if you go any further, you will be hit. You sing your freedom song, and they still steal. Amazing, the songs did. Without the songs, personally, I believe that there wouldn't have been a civil rights movement. While in jail, sing and pray. I'll never forget when I was in jail and ever want to come out. So my mama said, girl, you need to come out and at least change clothes and put on some more if you want to go back. But when we went to jail, ladies had places to put stuff. You understand what I'm saying, ladies? We had compartments. You know, like the luggage. We could put out, you know, our toothbrushes and our soap and wash plugs and extra panties. We had places to put those things. So every time we went on the march, we were ready. Because we knew that we would be arrested. Anytime you march or picket, just know that you're going to be arrested. We didn't mind being arrested because we knew we were fighting for our freedom. I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. I ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land.
Billy.
Probably should have played this one before that, but one of my personal favorites. And she did Little Light, This Little Light of Mine, and Dog, Dog, Dog. She taught us, and Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. But just a short song, just a couple-minute clip, song that I've been singing since I've been home. It's well-known from the movement. Just a couple minutes long. Here's Aretha May singing Oh Freedom.
Freedom.
Oh, freedom! Oh, freedom! Oh, freedom! Over me, over me! I need all I need of faith. I need it in my brain, and go home to my door and be free, and be free. No.
Singing Oh Freedom, and as I said, I have four or five other songs, but I think we're going to move on. We left Albany and took a three-hour drive up to Montgomery, Alabama, the capital of the Confederacy, at least the first one before they moved it to Richmond. And I had lived in Alabama and had been to Montgomery 25 years ago. What a surprise to see how it had progressed. And one of the fascinating things for me was how the South was so willing and ready to showcase how terrible it was to live there in the 50s and 60s, and the struggle of people of color, what they went through. And it certainly was a national dilemma, but in the South, they took it to a new level of segregation. But every city is like, build a museum and said, hey, come see what terrible people we were, and stay in our hotels and eat our food. And so they've kind of cashed in and made a business of civil rights. However, I'm not criticizing, because my goodness, they preserved our history, and the federal government certainly helped, but state governments did too, and local citizens, and so you really do have a substantial tour when you go, because we didn't even see it all. We didn't go to Tuskegee and other places of interest, but we did go up to Montgomery, did a quick tour. Then next day we went down and spent the day in Selma, entire day, and of course you drive over the bridge made famous by the Bloody Sunday March, and it was made even, I don't want to say more famous, but famous again, or brought back into the national consciousness in the movie that was released at the beginning of this year, Selma. And so the Edmund Pettus Bridge, I found out Edmund Pettus was a Confederate general. He was a Alabama senator, and he was a Grand Dragon in the Ku Klux Klan. So here we were driving over and then marching over the bridge, reenacting the march, certainly under better circumstances than the marchers back in 1965. Now, while we were in Selma, had the privilege of being taken around by Joanne Bland. Joanne Bland is sort of the face and the voice of Selma tours, and you see her on other documentaries. And I know when President Clinton was there, she took him around. And so Joanne is, as they would say in the South, she is nothing to trifle with. And another Southern saying would be, she is as strong as an acre of garlic. And she was arrested going across the bridge when she was 11. And, of course, that's 50 years ago, so you do the math. So she got on the bus, drove us around, took us to a fruit stand. I did see that Dr. Allen's at that fruit stand. They probably bought some peaches. And then on the bus, we were sitting on the bus, and she told the story of the march across the bridge on that Sunday. Now, when she started, I grabbed my recorder, so we're going to miss the very first part where she's talking about black blood. And what we're picking that story up, that she's talking about her mother died when she was young because she couldn't get a transfusion that she needed in Selma, in a Selma hospital, because they had no black blood. So she's going to pick the story up there. And so let's go. Let me find it here, Joanne Bland. And there it is. And so it's about 15 minutes. I was recording on the bus. You may hear the bus air conditioner. And I tried not to move the recorder too much. So, but sometimes it was unavoidable, and you will pick up those signs. But this voice you're going to hear for the next few minutes is Joanne Bland. But listen to her tell the story of that Bloody Sunday and what it was like to live in Selma, to be there on that day in those conditions. And then we'll move on from Selma once we listen to Joanne.
And they didn't have what my sister calls any black blood. I'm 61 and I still don't know what black blood is today. The blood had to be sent from Birmingham on the bus, and my dad was to pick it up and rush it over to the hospital so my mom could get her much needed transfusion. By the time the blood got here, it was too late. My mom was gone, and my baby brother that was in her tummy was too. My grandmother came back home, back to Selma from Detroit. She had lived about 35 years, and she couldn't understand how things had not changed since she had left. Things were still the same. She started talking to the women in the community, telling them about the freedom she enjoyed in Detroit. But grandma had what I now call that Mason-Dixon mentality. As soon as you get in the South, that whole mentality changes. You think
that it only happens here, when we know that's not true. It happens wherever the rainbow is. But grandmother was introduced to Mrs. Boynton, Sam and Amelia Boynton, who knew that if we could vote, we could change some of those laws that were unfair to us. She started going to the meetings of the Dallas County Voters League, an organization formed in the early 1930s. She would take us with her. We had to sit at the feet of those history makers while they strategized on how they were going to get this thing called freedom. I thought they were the dumbest old folks in the world. You know, my teachers had already told us that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. We had our freedom, and they didn't even know it. And one day we were standing in front of Carter's drugstore. Carter's had a lunch counter, and I wanted to sit at that lunch counter, but my grandmother said I couldn't. She said, colored children can't sit at the lunch counter. Every time I passed by Carter's, I was in Carter's drugstore, I'd be looking at the white kids sitting on the stool, looking at ice cream, looked like they were having so much fun. And just because she said I couldn't do it didn't stop me from wanting to do it. But one day, my grandmother was talking to one of her friends in front of Carter's, and I was doing what I always do. I was peeping in that window, wishing it was me. My grandmother noticed that day. She leaned over my shoulder and she said, when we get our freedom, you can do that too. I became a freedom fighter that day. I understood instantly that the freedom that grandmother and her friends were talking about was different from the one Abraham Lincoln had given me. Grandma was going for the good freedom that would let me sit on that stool. I started going down to First Baptist with my older sisters to the meetings of SNCC. I didn't like anything about it. They tried to teach me the principles of nonviolence. The only one I could really grasp was the one where they say turn the other cheek. I grew up in the hood. All I could envision was walking out of that door and somebody hitting me on one side and I turned the cheek for them to hit me on the other side. I'd be turning back and forth all day long. No, it wasn't going to happen. It got so bad when they started the nonviolence training, I'd act so ugly, my sisters would put me out. They'd lean over and say, you can go outside now, and I'd gladly go. I only liked the marching. When they would come out of church and line up, I'd get in the line, and I'd march, too. We'd march up to that courthouse we just passed. You know we weren't old enough to vote. They'd see us coming and lock the doors. We would kneel on the steps of the church, and someone would say a prayer, asking the Creator to lift the hearts of these evil men so that our parents could vote for us until we could vote for ourselves. You know, that got old quick. They started rolling yellow school buses up in front of the jail and loading us up on the buses and taking us to jail. They would put us in cells that were supposed to hold 1 to 2 people. I've never been in a cell that had less than 40 to 50 people all jammed up in it. If you were lucky or unlucky enough to get to bed, you didn't sit there long. The mattress was gone. Just the metal frame was there. And it had a lip right in front, so the mattress wouldn't slide off. Made it so uncomfortable to sit there. The toilet in the middle of the floor. That many people in a room that small, you don't want to be anywhere near a toilet. Food, dry beans. For those of you who cook beans, I have seen them being cooked. You know you can't just open that pack and put it in the water. You got to pick out the stuff you can't eat. The grass, the insects, the dirt, the rocks. Nobody did that for us. I think they took pride in bringing you a plate with a big old rock up on the sitting up on it. You'd be so hungry, you'd push that rock aside and hope you couldn't identify what you were crunching on. Those things were done to break our spirits, but we were as low as we could go. They let us out. We come home, take a bath, eat a good meal, be right back up in their faces because I still could not sit on that stool at Carter's. In December of 1964, a letter was written to a man named Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. An invitation was issued to him to be a speaker at on Emancipation Proclamation Day, January the 1st. It was written by the president of the Dallas County Voters League. His name was Frederick Douglass Reese. Dr. King accepted that invitation. He already knew of the work that SNCC had been doing here in Selma. He already knew of the work that the League had been doing here in Selma toward voter registration. He chose Selma to be the battleground for voting rights in these United States. Things really heated up then. Dr. King stationed his lieutenants in places all around us throughout the Black Belt. They started organizing in their counties. And voter registration drives were going on daily throughout the Black Belt. He sent James Orange, Reverend James Orange, to Perry County, small rural county approximately 30 miles west of us. In Perry County, Reverend Orange managed to organize students. They marched on their courthouse and were arrested, including Reverend Orange. Reverend Orange himself told me that a state trooper came into the area where he was housed about 3 o'clock that day with a rope. On the end of that rope was tied a noose, and he threw it over the top of his cell, and that noose hung in his face all day long. He said he had to sit there knowing it may be his last day on earth. That evening, they let the children out. They kept Reverend Orange. A mass meeting was held. Being held at a church approximately 2 blocks from the jail. The children ran into the meeting and said, "You have to do something. You have to do something now. They're going to kill him." The people in the church decided they would walk down to that jail and walk around it all night long in case their mere presence could save this man's life. When they left the church, they were attacked and brutally beaten by law enforcement officers. A young man named Jimmy Lee Jackson emerged from the church just in time to see a state trooper beating his grandfather, his 82-year-old grandfather. He pleaded with this trooper not to beat his grandfather. He's an old man, taken to jail if he's done something wrong. Jimmy's mother saw them beating her father too, and she ran over. As she approached, that trooper drew back his billy club to hit her. Jimmy put up his hand to stop him, and that trooper shot him. Jimmy died 8 days later at Good Samaritan Hospital. It was then that the leaders decided to walk from Selma to Montgomery, one to protest this young man's death, the other to demand the right to vote for our then Governor George Wallace. On March 7th, we gathered on that cement where you picked up that rock. And led by John Lewis and Hosea Williams, came right down this street and over that same bridge. We met a wall of policemen. That line stopped. John Lewis asked permission to pass. The policeman said, "There will be no march between Selma and Montgomery. You have 2 minutes to disperse and go back to your church." In 1 minute and 15 seconds, they attacked. It was horrible. I had never experienced violence. Marching was fun to me. I liked the spirit of the movement, the songs, the chants, being with my friends, not going to school. I liked all of that. When I crested that bridge and I could see across, I saw those policemen lined up all the way across all 4 lanes. I saw policemen on each side. I knew we were not going to Montgomery. I was too far back in the line to hear or see what was happening. I didn't need to. I was a warrior. I knew the procedure. I knew when I crested that bridge and saw those policemen that John Lewis or Hosea Williams would ask permission to pass. It would be denied. Then John and Hosea would go down on their knees and go to the Creator in prayer. One of them would say the prayer. After prayer, they would stand up. We would follow suit. They would either take us back to Brown Chapel or to the playground where we started from. We either plan a new strategy or just regroup and come right back. I'm standing there waiting for the front to go down when suddenly I heard gunshots and screams. I thought they were killing the people down front. Before we could turn to run, it was too late. They came in from the front and the back, both sides, and they were just beating people. Old, young, black, white, male, female, didn't matter. They were just beating people. It's the screams I remember the most. People were screaming and screaming and screaming. People lay everywhere, not moving, bleeding. And you couldn't stop to help them or you'd be beaten too. The gunshots I heard, nobody was shooting bullets on that bridge that day. It was the tear gas canister. Tear gas burns your eyes, gets in your lungs, you can't breathe, you can't see, you panic. Oftentimes you run right back to the same people you're running from. It seemed like it lasted an eternity. If you could outrun those men on foot, you couldn't outrun the ones on horses. The horses were afraid. They were rearing and kicking and trampling people. Bones were being broken. The last thing that I remember seeing on that bridge that day is this horse and this lady. I don't know what happened. The man on the horse hit her and she fell. Did the horse run over her? I don't know. I do know. As I sit here 50 years later, I can still hear the sound her head made when it hit that pavement. The next thing I remember, I was on this side of the bridge in the back of a car right on the side of the building on the Water Avenue side. My head was in my sister Linda's lap and Linda was crying. When I became fully awake, I realized falling on my face was not my sister's tears. It was her blood. My 14-year-old sister had been beaten on that bridge and had wounds in her head that required 26 stitches. Yet on that Tuesday, March 9th, I held that same sister's hand as I, along with others, followed Dr. King across that bridge again. When I crested that bridge and saw those same policemen lined up across all four lanes, I ain't want no more freedom. I didn't want to play no more. Whatever the cost of this freedom was just too much for this 11-year-old. I tried to go back, but my sisters held my hand firmly and they kept talking. Finally, I heard one of them say, "Come on, they're not gonna beat Dr. King." I went, but I was scared. This time, Dr. King asked permission to pass. The policeman told him the same thing. There would be no march between Selma and Montgomery. But this time, the front went down. Dr. Abernathy said a prayer. After prayer, he and Dr. King stood up and led us back to Brown Chapel, where Dr. King held the mass meeting. At that mass meeting, he told us he had applied for a court order that would give us the legal right to walk from Selma to Montgomery if we so wanted to. Court order was signed by a judge in Montgomery named Frank Johnson on March 17th. And on March 21st, we left Brown Chapel one more time, came down this street and over that same bridge. And those same policemen who beat us up on the 7th had to protect us all the way from Selma to Montgomery. It was 5 days of walking. It started raining on the second day. Nobody turned around. There are no motels between Selma and Montgomery now. There were none then. People slept on the ground. Everything had to be brought to them. And do you know, August 6th of that very same year, the Voting Rights Act was signed and it removed those obstacles that prevented us from voting. Here in Selma, in Dallas County, which Selma is the county seat, we had 250 African Americans on the roll out of a possible 15,000. Went to 9,600. Almost immediately. And it still took us 36 years to get rid of the same mayor that was on the bridge. Go figure. It's just not good enough to vote. You gotta be involved in the process. Because the same people who were trying to keep us from getting the right to vote were the same people who were in charge of the election. As soon as we became totally immersed in that system, we got us a new mayor. Things have not changed a whole lot in Selma, but changed that things have changed a whole lot, if you know what I mean. Selma, like most small towns, got hit real hard with this recession. Hopefully, just like the rest of the United States, we'll bounce back soon. Any questions? Is that a no?
All right. Yeah, I apologize. Joanne was at the front of the bus speaking on the bus loudspeaker with the microphone, and I was about two-thirds of the way back, so I just put the recorder as close to a speaker as I could. So, but I hope you heard what she was talking about, what it was like in Selma before the march and what it was like during the march. One of the insights she gave us that isn't always made public or clear is that the violence continued through the whole day and into the night. And it wasn't just that they chased the police chased them over the bridge. They chased them right into the churches. And a lot of the policemen were Klans members, so this was their chance to misbehave with impunity. And, of course, they did. God was watching, and God will judge and take care of things. But other than that, the marchers were really unprotected and on their own. So we went from Montgomery, where we spent the day after Selma, on up to Birmingham and met some couple of delightful ladies, one of whom is Carolyn McKinstry. Carolyn was in the 16th Street Baptist Church as a 14-year-old Sunday school clerk on the Sunday in September of 1963 when the church was bombed and four children were killed and one was blinded. And so Carolyn has written a book, While the World Watched, and so she came and spoke to us along with Lisa McNair, the sister of one of the girls who was killed in the bombing. And so Carolyn, delightful woman, interesting, as I was blogging, somebody wrote me from my church here in Pittsburgh and said she had read Carolyn's book, couldn't put it down. It's something we recommend to you, While the World Watched. And so Carolyn's just gone through some seminary training. And the reason I want you to listen to this, we were listening to these remarks, and little did we know it that in South Carolina the massacre in the church was going on as we were listening. And Carolyn was burdened about hatred in our country and where it was going and where it was all going to end. And lo and behold, as she's talking, this was going on in South Carolina. So let's go ahead and listen. It's about a 30-minute interview with Carolyn McKinstry, and in Birmingham, author of While the World Watched, talking about what it was like to grow up in a segregated South, what it was like to be in the 16th Street Baptist Church in the morning of September 1963 when the church was bombed and those little girls died. Let's listen in.
Todd for the chairs. I may sit shortly, but good evening to everyone and welcome to Birmingham again, Todd. And I don't know if we have people that have been here before, but welcome, and I hope you've had a great visit, seen a lot of good things. I think my job this evening is just to talk to you a little bit about growing up in Birmingham and about the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church and some of the things that I've done since that time. And then I'll be happy to answer your questions as well, if you have questions. I brought my book as well. A lot of times when I start with students in the room, I will read an excerpt from the Birmingham Racial Segregation Laws. You can read them, you can see them in places, but they have a whole different feel when someone reads them out loud. And so let me see where you guys are. Has everybody read the book?
Just a couple chapters.
Okay. All right, so maybe we'll go back and do that. But where did it all start? It started with those laws for me. So that's why I usually start with reading those. But I'll tell you that just a little family background, I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, born about 50 miles from here in Atlanta. And my parents moved to Birmingham when I was two, and they joined 16th Street Baptist Church when I was two. And so that's how long I have been a member of the church. I was not the oldest member there, but probably had the longevity simply because of when they came. I like to tell people it was a really fun place to be. I played all over the church. I knew all the secret spots. And we did a lot of really good things. I represented them at a lot of conferences, youth conferences. I remember one in Oklahoma, one in Michigan. The one in Oklahoma, we got a chance to see Oral Roberts University back in the day. And so, and then many times on Sunday, they would have programs, and we would be given the role of reading scripture, praying, or doing various things. Especially if it was youth day, we were assigned everything. So this was really, I think, accounts for a lot of the young people that came out of the church were very comfortable talking with people, with going places, because we had very good role models around us, but we were given the opportunity, even probably lots of times we weren't that good or that exciting to them, but they always treated us as though we had done something really magnificent, and I guess after a while you begin to believe that. So it was really a great place to be. It was also good for me because my parents were very strict, and I would tell people sometimes that my dad was the strictest man in Alabama. I had four brothers and one sister, and I had a brother accompany me everywhere per my dad, and so I took those brothers to church, and you know, we just had a big family. I really enjoyed church life, but church was the one place I could always get permission to go. I couldn't date. I had my only date when I graduated from high school. My date's father picked me up at the house. I went to the prom, and my date's father brought me back to my mom and dad. So that was my first date before I went off to college. That gives you some idea of just really how strict things were. But I think deep in the back, in the recesses of my father's mind, he taught school by day. He had a master's in physics and chemistry. But in the evenings and on the weekends, he waited tables. And he waited tables at a place here in Birmingham called the Birmingham Country Club. It's located in a place called Mountain Brook. And it was a club that had no black membership then, and to my knowledge has none today. Right. It has one or two, I think Condi Rice is an honorary member, and there are one or two other people that go. They have honorary privileges, but they don't boast of any members. So I think in the process of working there, my dad learned a lot of things. And one of the things I said in the book was we could always tell when he had heard something or learned something in this job at the club. I think he was kind of invisible as a waiter. But those things he learned always translated into new rules for us. And one, for example, he came home one day and said, our boundaries had changed. We knew how far we could go on skates and bikes when we were out playing, but one day the boundaries changed. And I was always the person that wanted to know why. You know, I was the problem person in the house. Or you could say I was the questioning person in the house. But I mean, why can't we go past this block? And he never told me, but in years later, years past, probably I'd say 20 years or more past, I learned that the place that he didn't want us to go was an area where Robert Cherry lived. He was the last person convicted of the bombing of the church. His house is still there, and it's right across the street from one of the, I'm trying to think of the name of the last name, but there's a group here, has a chain of barbershops and beauty shops, and it's right across the street from a place we used to go and get our hair done. So I figured out in later years why he didn't want us to go beyond this certain point. But I think part of that also, so that we wouldn't get hurt, but also that we wouldn't frighten us. If he had told us why, it might have been frightening. I spent a lot of time at the church, probably in the seventh grade, somewhere thereabout. I became our Sunday school secretary. My grandfather was a preacher, country preacher and an educator, so I would go down in the summers and do vacation Bible school and teach Sunday school, and I really thought, you know, when I was 10 or 12, I just thought I was really somebody working in the church, you know. But it has that effect on you, it develops confidence. So because of all the work I had done with my grandparents, I think it just sort of transferred over when things became available in the church, and I found myself just working and doing things in the church. I just happened to be there when the first mass meeting started, and before the marching started, 16th Street Church, Baptist Church, had its own history. It was a church built by people that were less than 50 years out of slavery. They bought it, built it at a cost of about $36,000, and when they went in it, it was paid for. And the church, if you haven't been there already, there is kind of a very special spirit in the church when you go in. But they were very proud people. Most of the early pastors had earned doctorates, which was really an accomplishment back then. Many of those pastors wrote books on things like how to buy a house, how to have a savings account. You know, they tended to the practical needs of the community. They knew that many of the people in the community could not read. They didn't have the kinds of jobs that we see today. They were not professional jobs. And so they spent a lot of time trying to develop their community. But I just happened to be there when the first mass meeting took place. I would go down sometimes and volunteer in the evenings and especially in the summers. But I was working in the back, and I heard this singing and this what I call fire speeches in the sanctuary. And when I peeped out, and the church was just completely full. And the energy was there because it was pretty much all young people, ages maybe 11, best I could see, 11, 12, 13, and some, my age, I was 14 then. And then there were older children who were 18, 19, 20. I wasn't sure what they were doing, but it was so energizing, it was so exciting, I just knew that I wanted to be part of it. So I closed up the office, put the things away, and I went out and took a seat. And this was the first time that I saw these six men, Martin Luther King, Fred Shuttlesworth, Ralph, wasn't the first time I saw Reverend Shuttlesworth, but Ralph Abernathy, Andrew Young, James Bevel, and Jesse Jackson. And they were talking about the segregation that existed in Birmingham. And we were all very familiar with that because we could not use the public library. We had designated days to go to the zoo. If we shop downtown, we could not try on the clothes. That's really hard, ladies, you know, trying to get your stuff together. But it was difficult for guys, too. Having four brothers, I watched my mom hold the pants by their legs, just trying to make sure there was enough lint there. We always had to take a clean pair of socks when we were going to get those shoes. Most of our tennis came from Sears, the Sears Jeepers back in the day. So we were very much aware of what we couldn't do. You know, my parents tried to keep us from riding the bus, but if you rode the bus, you sat in the back, and if someone moved that little sign that said white on one side and black on the other side, you had to move. So we had just one car, but to the extent that they could drop us off at things or not, we just stayed home. To the extent that they could do that, we were sort of spared the when I look back on it now, and being a parent myself, everything was always about money in our house. When we would ask to do things, my dad would just cry broke. He didn't have any money. But with six kids in the house and four of them boys who ate a lot, it was easy to believe that we were broke, you know. And so, but I think what it was, depending on what you asked for, when they opened the first Jack's hamburger place in Birmingham, and we all wanted to go, you know, French fries and hamburgers, and we had never been to a place like that. And my mom said, Jack's? Who's got money for Jack's? By the time we buy food for all of you all, we can buy a week's worth of groceries. That was probably true, too. But the Jack's hamburgers were 15 cents when they first opened, you know. And so everything was always sort of silenced or shushed away with, no, we don't have the money to do that. And so we kind of grew up just believing that. But we didn't know why things were the way they were. We just knew they were. There was a bookmobile that came to my school every 2 weeks, and you go out and if you saw books you wanted, you check on them. My real introduction, and I've mentioned these two stories in the book, but My grandmother was brought to Birmingham by my grandfather, and the hospitals didn't take black people. My mom was able, because it was a Baptist hospital and my grandfather was a Baptist preacher. They took my grandmother, but they put her in the basement of the hospital. I have actually encountered two people since that time. One teaches school here, and he says his grandfather was president of the board of that hospital during the time that my grandmother would have been trying to get in there. And he actually came to me, teaches at Indian Springs School, he came to me and said, I owe you an apology for my grandfather. Well, I know how hospitals set policies, that his grandfather probably didn't set that policy, nor did he. But I was really glad to meet him and to speak with him. And during the time that my grandmother was there in the basement, my parents came and said, well, we have to work. And we want somebody to stay with her. We don't want her to stay by herself. So that became my job, sitting in the basement there with her. It took about 2 weeks for her to die. She was 54 years old. She taught first grade, and we never knew what was wrong with her. We were never able to know. And I kind of really don't believe the doctors knew, but we never knew why she died. But I knew, I was old enough to understand she was in the basement. I did understand that, and I wondered why. And when you're sitting in a basement day in and day out for 2 weeks, all you're looking at the pipes and the floor, and you know there's not much to see, but there's a lot to think about. The second introduction came when I won the spelling competition in Birmingham. I was sort of dragged kicking and screaming into that competition, but I competed in all the city schools and then the county schools, and ended up being our champion speller. But back in that day, black children could not be part of the national spelling competition either, for the same reason. So it still had not struck me quite to the point of, I was trying to understand it, but it wasn't troubling. I was wondering about things, and it was troubling, and I felt sad because I really loved my grandmother. I spent so much time with her, a place she could never do wrong, you know, in her house. So I began to think about it. But by the time the marches started in Birmingham, was when the wheels really sort of began to turn about what was going on in Birmingham. And I realized then, and what's so troubling about what I realized then is that I kind of feel the same way today. That in so many places across our country, what color I am is much more important than what I've accomplished or who I'm trying to be or who I've tried to help or reach out to. Our country is so preoccupied with color. I mean, that's all we see in the news and the papers and things. And God has blessed me to be able to travel to many other countries. And I just, one of the things I took note of is that I don't see that preoccupation with what color people are. I mean, it's an obsession. It's a 24-hour obsession in this country. And so it's troubling when you, as a black person, when you come to that realization. And it's more troubling if you have children. Because like my parents, then I was challenged with what am I going to say to my children. I never heard my grandfather speak anything ugly about people, black or white. I never heard him speak hatred toward whites. And he lived in an area of Clanton. Someone asked me not long ago, is that the place that was once called Klan Town? K-L-A-N-T-O-W-N, but now it's C-L-A-N-T-O-N. Well, I didn't know, and he passed away, so I couldn't ask him that question. But when I look at the area where he lived, aware now of a lot of things that went on during that time. And then I began to look at Birmingham. And I think that I gravitated to ministry and to the notion of reconciliation probably out of a sadness and a fear. But then what happened, the more I began to travel and go places, I began to meet people. And you come to realize that Birmingham is just a small microcosm in the grand scheme of things. And the world is not Birmingham. And the people that I met in all these places was not Birmingham. I've been privileged to go to India, to New Delhi and Mumbai, to Spain, I was in Israel my last trip, been to Ireland, Scotland, and to Rome, and I just haven't seen what I see here. And so, you know, these things were going through my head. I was watching what was going on around Birmingham. Didn't really mean to get involved in marching, but I was there that Sunday, so I marched one time. And when I came home, my father told me that was the only time I would not to go back. I got sprayed with a water hose on that occasion. And this would have been in May in, of 1963, but in September, I want to just talk a little bit about Sunday morning. And I arrived at church with two younger brothers, Alan, who was 6, and Wendell, who was 10. And this was just a regular Sunday. Put them in their class, collected my books so I could record attendance and money. And then about 10:15, my job was to go back and get all these reports and summarize them. And when Sunday school reconvened, I just read that report. Here's the attendance, here's the money, and here was our lesson for today. And so this was what happened on that Sunday. About 10:15, when I got up and left my class, I walked around and collected things, and then I started upstairs. And you guys haven't been to the church yet, right? I don't think you have. Just outside? Okay. So the space where the girls were in 1963 is not a space that you can touch today. It's not a space you can walk in. When the church was renovated, there at the time of the bombing of the church, there were police recorded over 80 unsolved bombings. No one had been brought to trial for those 80 unsolved bombings. So the church really didn't think that anybody was going to be brought to trial for that either. So when they renovated the church, they sealed that portion off. And so you can't walk in that space today. But if you could, when you do get inside, downstairs there's 2 steps right above it. There's a sign that says exit. And if we could turn right where those 2 signs was, once upon a time there was a door there. Once upon a time there were steps on the outside of that. If you could turn right where the bathroom was and go through the wall and be outside, then you would be where the steps were and where the person planted the bomb. But I just passed the bathroom. I was carrying my materials. I saw the girls in there. I spoke and went on because for 2 things. One, it was youth day. We had a lot to do. The other thing was that we had a meeting that day, a club meeting scheduled. Good evening to everyone, and welcome to Birmingham again, Todd. And I don't know if we have people that have been here before, but welcome. And
thanks again for listening to this week's edition of Ministry Beat with your host, John Stanko. Join us again next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the ACAC Internet Radio Network for more interviews and insight into the life of Allegheny Center Alliance Church. You can also access this show by going online to www.blogtalkradio.com/ACAC Threads. Thank you, and tell your friends about Ministry Beat.